So welcome, everybody, to May 2023's HR Briefing podcast. And my name is Matthew Ramsey. I'm the senior knowledge lawyer in the employment team. And I'm joined this month by somebody who isn't an employment lawyer, but who knows everything there is to know about one particular aspect of employment, and that is the wonderful world of tax. Phil Swinburne from the McFarlane's tax team specializes in employment tax, which is incredibly relevant to the topics we're going to talk about today. Lots of you, no doubt, will have grappled over the last couple of years with the horrible words IR35, CEST, off-payroll working. Try to understand how your consultant groups should be properly taxed. And that's relevant not just for traditional sectors which use consultants, contractors on a heavier rate, so for instance, IT contractors, but for everyone who outsources any part of their workforce. So, Phil, do you want to start then just by giving our devoted listeners a basic understanding of how the IR35 scheme works and what its policy genesis is?
Absolutely. Thank you, Matthew. And hello, everyone. So IR35 is something that dates back over 20 years now. And it was something that was brought in by Gordon Brown with the dawn of the dot-com boom in around 2000. So in 1999, Inland Revenue Bulletin 35, which is where IR35 comes along, was published. And the aim of that bulletin, which led to the first legislation brought in to cover this area of law, was to combat the mischief where an individual, an employee, could leave work as an employee on a Friday and return to work as a contractor on a Monday with a much nicer tax outcome. So the purpose of IR35 was to combat that, so that the payments to the individual in their capacity as a contractor were effectively treated in the same way as payments to an employee for tax purposes, and so subject to PAYE and national insurance deductions. And just a point for going forward on this podcast today, I'll refer to those things together as employment taxes, just as a general term. So the IR35 legislation combated that mischief, and the purpose of it was to say that if an individual, a contractor, was effectively providing services in the same way that they were providing services as an employee, or indeed a separate contractor came in and provided services in the same way as an employee, they would be treated in the same way for tax purposes.
And why does that matter for tax? You said that you'd have a beneficial tax treatment if you came back as a contractor. What kind of money difference does it make in practice for people?
So for an employee, employees or payments to employees by employers are subject to deductions for PAYE, so that's income tax deductions. They're also subject to deductions for employee national insurance. And there's also an employer cost, so employer national insurance. And the marginal rates at present for those three things, so the marginal rate of income tax is 45%, 2% for employee national insurance, and 13.8% for employer national insurance. Contrast to that, the payments to contractor who uses a personal services company, and I'll come on to why that's relevant in a moment, the personal services company would be paid on a gross basis. So there would be no additional employer cost for national insurance. And then that personal services company, usually a limited company, would distribute those payments to the contractor, usually as a mixture of a general earnings payment, so a small salary and a dividend payment. There are also additional deductions that can be claimed within a personal services company that can't be claimed by an employee. The tests are slightly different as to what's deductible. So really, it allows an individual to extract money received for their services at a much lower effective tax rate than they would have got as an employee.
And presumably you also get a cash flow benefit as well, because you're not being, those deductions that are being made when you're an employee come out of your monthly paycheck, as you say, through PAYE on a month-by-month basis. Presumably as a contractor, you can just put in your company's and your own personal tax returns at the end of the year and pay it all that way. And so you've got a sort of a cash flow benefit.
Exactly right. So it's a combination of the different ways of extracting money from a personal services company, the deductions that can be claimed, and also the cash flow benefit. So an individual who is a self-employed contractor might only need to pay their income tax 9 months after the end of the UK tax year, whereas payments to an employee are subject to deductions at source. They only see the net amount.
Got it. So let's just deal with that little bit of jargon that you launched in with, the personal services company, the PSC. So just so I'm clear, that's where instead of being a McFarlane's employee, I say, in fact, guys, I'm going to set up Matthew Ramsay Limited, and that entity, that corporate vehicle, is going to enter into a company-to-company agreement with McFarlane's, under which my company, my personal services company, undertakes to provide my services to McFarlane's. Is that the basic structure?
That's the basic structure. And it's worth pointing out at this point that IR35 only technically applies where an individual contracts through an intermediary entity, usually a personal services company. In situations where an individual doesn't contract through an intermediary entity, the end user, so the entity that's in receipt of the services provided by the contractor, is still required to make an assessment as to the employment status of the contractor. But generally, the tax benefits are not quite as stark, because the only real difference is that there's no employer nix cost where a contractor is paid through the provision of services as a sole trader, rather than paying that intermediary entity, which would then take deductions and those other things that I mentioned.
Understood. So HR teams traditionally engage with questions of employment status when they're thinking about, you know, is this person covered by the unfair dismissal regime? Is this person subject to the anti-discrimination legislation? So as no doubt most of you will be familiar with, employment law traditionally has three different categories. So people can either be a genuine employee, or they can be purely freelance contractor. Whether you call it freelance, contractor, consultant, we'll probably use all of those terms interchangeably today. And then there's a third category, this intermediate category of worker, who have some employment law protections, but not others. But Phil, the position in tax doesn't quite match that tripartite split for employment.
Not quite. In tax, we only really consider whether an individual is either employed for tax purposes or self-employed for tax purposes. Just stepping back to IR35 and the policy aims, the original IR35 legislation was introduced in the early 2000s, and the effect of that was to require personal services companies, so the limited companies used by contractors, to make an assessment as to the tax status of that contractor. Where it was considered that the individual should be treated as an employee for tax purposes, the payment that they received as a result of their services provided as a contractor needed to be reclassified, and a deemed employment payment was calculated. And this payment would then be subject to income tax and national insurance, effectively bringing them in line with an employee who is providing the same services. So as I mentioned, the assessment was required to be made by the contractor and their limited company. That differs from where an individual doesn't contract or didn't contract through a personal services company, where the end user, the entity in receipt of services, was required to make that assessment.
Understood. Okay. So the risk of getting that assessment wrong sat with where an intermediary was in place, sat with the intermediary itself.
That's right. And the more recent rule changes, and what's brought this into stark focus in recent years, is that from 6th of April 2021, the requirement to make that assessment moves from the personal services company to the end user, where that end user is either medium or large company. So small companies are exempt from having to make that assessment, and it's still the responsibility of the personal services company to make that assessment, that determination. But medium and large companies are required to make the assessment themselves.
Most of our clients probably will fall into that medium or large category, I assume.
That's right, Matthew. We would expect most of our clients to be considered medium or large. The tests are that the entity must meet at least two of the following three criteria for two consecutive financial years: a turnover of more than 10.2 million, a balance sheet total assets of more than 5.1 million, and an average of more than 50 employees. So those are the three criteria that need to be considered when determining whether a company is medium or large.
And if you are medium or large, then it's now your responsibility to look at your contractor workforce and say, for each of the individuals who comes on site to perform services provided through an intermediary, what is that person's hypothetical status? Is that roughly how the analysis works?
That's right. So technically, the legislation requires that entity to take reasonable care in making that determination. So they would need to look at the nature of the engagement, looking at First off, the contract between the parties, and also the way in which services are actually provided. And failure to do so, if an individual is treated like a contractor and paid on a gross basis, where really they should have been subject to or treated as a deemed employee for tax purposes, then they've failed to correctly withhold PAYE and national insurance and failed to pay employer national insurance. So really, an assessment needs to be made, and failing to do so can potentially give rise to, in the first instance, just those liabilities. The PAYE and employee national insurance should be recoverable from the individual, provided a company has sufficient indemnities in place. And maybe we'll come on to the practical steps a bit later. But there's also an employer NICS cost that would need to be factored in. Failure to take reasonable care would potentially also give rise to penalties. So failure to do so on a careless basis could give rise to penalties of up to 30% of the PAYE and NICS that weren't paid. And that goes as far as 100% of the unpaid PAYE and NICS where actions are deliberate and concealed.
And where we're talking about regulatory oversight of the employment regime in a sort of a wide sense, we've talked on previous podcasts about the role of the FCA, the role of the PRA, the role of the Solicitors Regulation Authority. Turning to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, is that an assertive body? Do they have contractors and their clients firmly in their sights at the moment? Or is this just a sort of a hypothetical risk that lawyers like to bang on about, but which doesn't actually make any difference in practice?
The key implication of the change to the IR35 rules on the 6th of April 2021 was it made enforcement much more straightforward. So if you take a large corporation that engages with multiple contractors, say hundreds of contractors, previously HMRC would have had to inquire into each of those contractors' personal services companies, their personal tax affairs, and assess the employment status on an individual basis. With the rule change pushing the responsibility to make the determination to the end user, HMRC's inquiry just starts with looking at the procedures and checks and balances that entity has in place in order to ensure that IR35 and the off-payroll worker rules are being correctly applied, which has encouraged them and which has led to a lot of contractors being concerned around that end user making a blanket determination to manage their own risk without looking further into it. In the first year of these rules being enforced, so 21-22 UK tax year, HMRC's stated position was that they would not be aggressive in their inquiries and that they would not apply penalties where the IR35 rules were not correctly implemented. But that grace period is over, and we are starting to see inquiries, starting off with the processes they have around the contractor population, and demonstrating that reasonable care has been taken is the first step in ensuring that you have constructive dialogue with HMRC and ensure that any penalties or any consequences of not making that determination correctly doesn't give rise to additional liabilities. So to answer your question, it's something that is of an increasing focus for HMRC. It's an easy thread for them to pick at because they can ask one or two very open questions. How many contractors do you have and what do you do about making those assessments? Those questions can quickly escalate.
Should we just look at some of the recent cases in this area, which I suppose give the support to your last remark that the revenue are active in this area? And you can see that by the number of cases that go through the tax tribunals.
Yes. I mean, the first point to note really around the tax tribunals is that the discussion in the tribunals and the judgments that have come out of them really show the complexity in this area. And that's something that HMRC do recognize. They recognize that making these employment status assessments is a challenging thing to do. And there really is a lot of nuance to making that determination. I think the best place to start when considering case law around IR35 is Ready Mixed Concrete case. All the IR35 and employment status, or certainly tax employment status cases, hark back to Ready Mixed Concrete and the employment status test set out in that case. They hinge on three main factors. I mean, and these continue to be the factors that HMRC will drill into when making inquiries into the employment status of contractors. So the first is around personal service, whether the contractor is actually required to be the one to provide the services that their intermediary entity is engaged to provide. So if you think about a standard business-to-business relationship, a company might engage McFarlane's to provide services. They might want you, Matthew, to be the one to provide services, but really they're engaging McFarland's. And how McFarland's provide those services is ultimately up to McFarland's, the business providing those services. It's not necessarily the case that an individual needs to provide those services. So that's clear when there's a completely contracted out service. But where you're engaging with a contractor, the way to consider the nature of personal services is to think about whether a substitute could be provided to perform the service. If you set up Matthew Ramsey Limited, but you can send your friend John to provide those services, then we would say, okay, there's a right of substitution. And so there isn't a personal service expectation that there would be in an employer-employee relationship. So that's the first test that we think about when we look at ready-mix concrete. The second, and probably the test that we see most of the discussion around where there is real nuance, is around control. So ultimately, how, when, and where services are provided by a contractor. And the two ends of the spectrum, so an employee would expect to be told basically how, when, and where they provide their services. There might be a degree of flexibility in that, but ultimately there is oversight and supervision as to the way those services are provided in an employment relationship. Whereas in a true business-to-business relationship, the end user is buying a service rather than the services of an individual. So how, when, and where they provide that service does not really matter to them as long as they get the desired outcome. I think we'll come back to control because it comes up in a lot of the other cases. And the third point that I just wanted to draw out of ready-mix concrete is the concept of mutuality of obligation. So in an employment relationship, an employer has an expectation that the employee will provide the services requested. And equally, that employee has an expectation of their employer that they will be asked to provide certain services. There's an overarching contract that reinforces that mutuality of obligation, where the employee continues to be expected to be engaged to provide those services. So even in a fixed term contract, it's still a contract of employment because it's an agreement between those two parties that the provision of services will be required and be remunerated. Whereas in a business-to-business, an end-user contractor relationship, really it's just an individual service that is being contracted for. And there's often a gray area where a contractor might be engaged for an ongoing task or services that are provided on an ongoing basis, but there isn't necessarily the expectation that that would continue in the way that might be present in an employment relationship.
So in employment, we often talk about that being the wage work bargain that underpins the employment relationship. So I turn up for work and I get paid for it. And in some ways, you can see that that same sort of basic concept is present even when I engage a builder to repair my garden wall, for instance. You know, I pay them, they turn up. But qualitatively, those relationships are fundamentally different. As you say, Phil, I don't really care whether the builder turns. I want my garden wall rebuilt. That's my only game aim in life. I don't really care whether Barry or John or Derek builds the wall, and I want it done by a particular fixed deadline. I don't really care whether they do it on Monday or Tuesday that week. So those tests of personal service and of control and of mutuality are very different. And we talked at the beginning about the employment status having three parts for employment rights and employment protections, but only two elements, two choices for tax. But actually, Ready Mix Concrete, this seminal decision from the 1960s, is the starting point for both employment protection and employment tax status inquiries. And that's even though the cases now are dealt with by the Employment Tribunal for Employment Rights and Employment Protections and by the First Tier Tax Tribunal and the Upper Tax Tribunal for Tax Matters, they both actually start from the same place.
It's absolutely right that they start from the same place. What is interesting and what has been drawn out in some of the tax cases is that the tax tribunal and the employment tribunal are very different places and they have very different adjudicators. For example, a judge in an employment tribunal is likely to be considering employment status far more regularly than a tax judge necessarily. Certainly in the first tier tax tribunal, where you might have a judge who's got a background in VAT or corporation tax. It's not to say that they don't understand the tests, but the lens through which they see them could be quite different. They're looking at things in a different way and don't necessarily apply the wider historical context in the same way. And it also means that they bring different things to the interpretation of the historic cases. For example, the concept of a mutuality obligation has really been interpreted quite differently by different tax judges who have almost separated the concept out into an overarching concept of a larger contract that might infer mutuality of obligation, and then a number of smaller contracts that might exist within that. So different qualities of mutuality of obligation, rather than simply saying there is or there isn't one. I want my builder to build this wall, or I don't want my builder to build this wall. You know, you might engage your builder to provide building services, and then within that overarching contract, you might say, can you build this wall here? And then contact them 3 months later and say, can you fix the garage? Something like that. Clearly, there are two distinct contracts, and it's a question as to whether there's an overarching mutuality of obligation between the parties, which in my example, clearly you say there wouldn't be.
So let's look at that in a bit more detail. And just as an aside, so employment rights practitioners, HR teams, employment lawyers, will be used to that same concept when you're looking at employment status for intermittent workers, atypical intermittent work, where the courts have traditionally looked at whether or not an umbrella contract is in place. And as Phil says, we're dealing with kind of similar but not exactly synonymous concepts throughout tax and employment status discussions. So should we turn then to mutuality and the big case of the football referees? That's the most recent one on mutuality, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Matthew. And I think it would be useful to look at the most recent judgment for the upper tribunal, the tax tribunal, and what they said, and then look at where we might find ourselves following the appeal in the Supreme Court that's happening in June this year. So to give this a bit of context, Premier League and high-level football referees in the UK are now, for the most part, engaged by the Professional Game Match Officials Limited, so an entity that engages them, and a lot of them are actually now treated as employees. But historically, all referees from grassroots level all the way up to the Premier League were self-employed individuals. And the argument that they were really relying on in order to, well, there were two arguments that they were relying on in order to make a claim for that status. So the first is that there was no mutuality of obligation between the referee who referees a match on a Saturday afternoon and the entity that was engaging them, be that the FA or the PG MOL, the Professional Game Match Officials Limited, who were providing the referees. There was no mutuality of obligation because those referees could say, yes, no, I don't want to do that game. I do want to do this game. And you can see how that's quite easily the case where you might have someone who does some refereeing in their spare time on a Saturday afternoon and doesn't want to go down to the local park to referee a local football match. But in reality, for the most part, for top level referees, there was an expectation that they would provide certain services in certain games. And HMRC took the view that really the contract that existed between the referee and the Professional Game Match Officials Limited really was an overarching indication of a mutuality of obligation between the parties. The secondary argument that the football referees had was that while refereeing football matches, they were not subject to the control of anyone else. They were merely applying the laws of the game as they saw fit without the oversight of anyone else. And so while the job determined where they would provide those services, how they did it was not something that was subject to oversight. So really, they were operating as autonomous consultants providing services.
And how did those arguments fare when they were tested in the tax tribunal and then in the Court of Appeal?
Really, the determinative factor was around mutuality of obligation. The courts found that there was a framework of control that was really exercised over the way that the referees provided those services. So while they weren't told that they needed to give a throw in there or a free kick there, really the rules of the game were not determined by them. They were merely applying that framework of control in providing their services.
And there was some control, wasn't there? Because they were marked if they had a good game or a bad game. There was some sort of FIFA Premier League sort of supervision in that sense.
There was supervision in that sense, and the court did find that that did look a lot like control. There's an important distinction to be drawn between supervision and control. I mean, it seems like we're splitting hairs, which really we sort of are when we're looking at employment status. But supervision and that oversight isn't enough to imply control. It's the fact that a referee would be marked and feedback given, and that might change the way they do it next time, which you might shake your head and say, okay, that just looks like give some hands-on supervision, really that's control. Whereas supervision in its lightest touch form could be merely looking at the actions of other people and saying, well, we're not going to have that person next time around. So there's a slight nuance to it.
Understood. Okay, well, we'll come back to control in a moment. So let's stick with referees and mutuality. So the, as you said, that this one's going up to the Supreme Court in June. Where do we think that that's likely to end up? And what more importantly, I suppose, what are the repercussions for the broader contractor landscape?
It's very difficult to make predictions about which way these IR35 and employment status cases are going to go. And I think that's reflected by the fact we've had so many cases reach the higher courts when we're looking at employment status. I think HMRC's view on mutuality of obligation is that the simplest contract between parties is sufficient to imply a mutuality of obligation. And so the fact that the referees seem to have ceded some points on control in the upper tribunal means that I wouldn't be surprised if the Supreme Court overturned that decision and took the view that these referees were in fact, or should in fact, have been treated as employees for tax purposes. So we'll have to wait and see.
One of the most interesting things I thought anyway, when I was rereading the football judgments ahead of this podcast, is just the enormous level of granular detail that that the courts have to wade through when they're examining these status questions. So we're not talking about a sort of a broad brush stand back, you know, do they look like employees? That's not the level of analysis that the tribunals have gone into. It's really exhaustive, you know, how is the request to referee a match communicated? What time, what day, what are the possible options open to the referee? At what point can they withdraw? Who does the post-match briefings? And it's exhaustive level of detail. And is it right then to say that that's the kind of level that our clients who have contractors really need to go into? That's the first question. And I suppose the second is it possible to draw any clear threads from any of these decided cases, given that they are so fact dependent?
An interesting question. I think there's a couple of points to draw out, really. The first is you mentioned taking a step back and looking at the wider facts and circumstances. And I think it's easy to get bogged down in the detail of these cases and look at the nuances and how it's been determined that mutuality of obligation does or doesn't exist and where there is or isn't control. I think the first thing to do in any employment status assessment is to take a step back and look at the facts in the round. And I think there's one of the more famous quotes on employment status assessments come from the Hall and Lorimer case. And the judge in that case said, what needs to be done when making any employment status assessment is to paint a picture using all of the facts and circumstances, and I'm paraphrasing here slightly, and look at that picture, and then you can make that determination. So that would always be the starting point for making an assessment.
So that's the kind of walks like a duck, talks like a duck test.
Yes, that's right. And I think stepping back and making that assessment will allow most businesses to make employment status determinations in the majority of cases. Clearly, there are nuances and grey areas, and a lot of the cases hinge on very, very small facts that prove to be determinative. So a number of cases have come out around TV presenters with differing outcomes. So there are a few cases that I'd just like to touch on. So the Chris Ackroyd and Lorraine Kelly cases are often held out as cases that demonstrate the inconsistency of the courts. But really, when you look closer, it just shows the minutiae of detail that is considered when making these employment status determinations. So Krista Ackroyd is a BBC TV presenter. She often presents the weather and various other news programs. And Lorraine Kelly engages through her personal services company and provides services to ITV. Her show is called Lorraine. It was found in the Ackroyd case that she should be treated as an employee for tax purposes, whereas in the Lorraine Kelly case, she was considered to be self-employed. And really, the way in which they provided services was quite similar. The degree of control that their relative end users had was quite similar. But what was different is that Lorraine had slightly less control and oversight over the way that she provided services on her show. So it's drawn out in her cases that while she couldn't decide who she would interview, she would have artistic freedom to decide what would and wouldn't be asked. And she could make decisions on the fly, whereas Krista Aykroyd was required to say and do certain things. And if the BBC said, we need you to present the weather in Leeds, please go up to Leeds and do that, she would generally do that. The fact that she didn't necessarily have to, but almost always did, was an important factor, and it indicated that there was a framework of control over the way she provided services. Krista Aykroyd was also subject to the Ofcom standards, but also the BBC reporting standards, whereas Lorraine was only subject to Ofcom standards. And that distinction in the control and framework of control over the way in which they provided services was ultimately determinative and worked in Lorraine's favour.
Those aren't the only media cases that have been looked at recently.
That's right.
How does Eamon Holmes fit into this picture?
So the Eamon Holmes judgment came out a few weeks ago now. And Eamon Holmes was considered to be an employee for tax purposes under the IR35 legislation. Again, this was all about control and the degree of autonomy that Eamon Holmes did or didn't have over the way he provided services.
So he was more like Krista Aykroyd than like Lorraine Kelly.
It was, but in the Holmes case, first in the first tier tax tribunal and latterly in the upper tribunal, there was quite insightful discussion into certain aspects of control, particularly that oversight point and the framework of control. So Eamon Holmes was required to sign up to the health and safety standards of ITV and also the Ofcom guidance. He provided services on Good Morning Britain, I think it was, and interviewed the individuals that ITV sent his way. He was fairly autonomous in the way he provided services, and ITV considered that he was just a senior consultant or a senior expert providing services as an independent contractor because he could attend rehearsals but generally didn't. He was given research information about the guests that he would be interviewing, but he would generally do his own research. It was recommended to him that he turn up within a certain time before appearing on the show, but you know, he decided those sorts of factors for himself. But really, the court looked at the framework of control and the fact that he was required to interview who they told him to interview. He did not have complete autonomy over what he said on air. And crucially, he was subject to the Ofcom regulations that needed to be overseen and implemented by ITV. So if he said something on air that was against those Ofcom regulations, it would be on ITV's head. And ultimately, ITV had to ensure that he met the required standards. So their requirement to enforce that regulatory oversight over Holmes' activities was seen as being a hallmark of control and a greater framework of control.
You'd expect some sort of similarity of approach across those three decisions, given that all three are, you know, from a layman's perspective, all three are TV presenters working through intermediary companies that they control. Yes, one's for the BBC, two for ITV, but they're all subject to Ofcom. It's quite surprising, isn't it, that the same conclusion wasn't reached in each case?
It is surprising, but it does highlight just how difficult and nuanced making those employment assessments are.
Presumably, it also makes it very difficult for clients to get it right and for advisors to be sure that we're getting it right.
Yes, absolutely. I think we'll come on to the HMRC tool towards the end of this discussion today, but it certainly does make it very difficult.
So before we leave the media cases, let's go to the other recent case that joins football and media very neatly that involved Gary Lineker. What was that all about?
So the Gary Lineker case was an interesting one and fairly disappointing when we consider the off-payroll worker rules and IR35. Really, the courts didn't get into the nitty-gritty of Gary's services or the way he provided services. In quite an obscure technicality that essentially determined that he wasn't engaging through an intermediary entity because he had signed on behalf of his partnership and so had really engaged directly. I think it's not worth getting into too much technical detail here. I think we can reasonably expect HMRC to challenge this decision. So it remains to be seen where we'll land with that. But we can, as I say, reasonably expect HMRC to be appealing the first tier tribunal decision.
So let's then loop all the way back to how clients can demonstrate that they take reasonable care over their contractor arrangements, or at least take reasonable care that they're taxing their contractors properly. What does an ideal contractor, if you definitely want to be outside the IR35 rules and able to take your gross fee into your consultancy entity and pay those dividends away and benefit from beneficial tax treatment, as you described at the beginning. What are the guarantees of doing that?
The first point to consider before looking at the employment status factors is whether an end user entity is really contracting out a service. So that would be a true business-to-business relationship where you might engage with a company. So to use McFarlane's example, you might engage with McFarlane's as a law firm to provide you certain legal services. At that point, where it's clearly a fully contracted out service, you don't need to consider the employment status tests. When you're looking at the employment status test, if we can't say, okay, this is an entirely contracted out service, the first thing that gives you a sort of slam dunk answer that an individual or a contractor is not a deemed employee for tax purposes is if there is a genuine unfettered right for substitution. So if your builder can provide someone else to provide those services and it really doesn't matter who, then there's no expectation of personal service and that contractor should not be treated as an employee for tax purposes.
And that goes back to the first test that you outlined from the old ready mixed concrete case.
That's right. In order for a substitution clause in a contract to be effective, it needs to be genuine. So there's no point putting one in if it could never really in practice be exercised. And a question that HMRC will ask when looking at these kinds of arrangements is whether a substitute has ever been provided. So having a clause that reflects reality is important. It's possible to slightly limit that clause so that the contractor must provide a suitably qualified or suitably experienced substitute. But if that substitute requires the express agreement of both parties and, you know, it's really a fettered right and it is ultimately something that the end user needs to vet and it's not a true right of substitution that really is determined by the contractor or their personal services company, then it won't be effective. So an unfettered right of substitution is our starting point. The second thing that we'd like to see in a genuine contractor arrangement is evidence that the contractor really has control over how and where they provide services. So if the engagement is prescriptive on all of these points, then we might not be able to rely on the fact that they are a contractor by virtue of there being a lack of control. But in an ideal arrangement, there wouldn't be that element of control and the contractual documents between the parties would reflect that. So you wouldn't say, you know, you need to be here between 9 and 6, and you wouldn't say that services will be overseen and directed by X within the end user's business. Really, you're just contracting for that service. I mentioned that HMRC generally consider that a mutuality of obligation exists where the parties are contracting, and that in theory could make mutuality of obligation a moot point when considering engagements and the underlying documentation. One way that it could be evidence that there is a lack of mutuality of obligation is through looking at the fee between the parties. So if there's a monthly retainer or even a day rate, and it's really doesn't matter what service is provided, ultimately the individual will receive their fee. That is an indication of a salary type payment and a payment that really is based on an overarching engagement rather than a specific service. So the preference would be for a specific service, a fee will be given. Clearly, that's not practical in all cases. And sometimes you might have to accept that there is really an overarching mutuality of obligation between the parties. But the preference where it is practically possible would be to have a fee for a service rather than a fee based on time spent.
And in the last bit of the ready mix concrete decision, so having outlined those three tests that you reminded us of earlier on in this episode, the judge then goes on and says, and once we've looked at those three formal tests, we're then going to stand back and look at any other relevant factors that point to or away from employment or self-employment. And presumably those allow judges then to take that broad brush, standing back and looking at the assessment in the round. You know, does the person have a corporate email? Do they have to have a uniform? Are they included in the promotional materials? All that kind of stuff. Is it possible to predict how a judge is going to weigh those different factors?
In short, no. These are all important factors, not quite ranking as highly as substitution, control, mutuality of obligation. But where none of those factors are determinative, we need to consider the wider factors. So you mentioned an email address. Really, we need to be able to distinguish between a contractor and an employee on the face of it. Another important factor is whether the individual provides their own equipment. And another one is whether the contractor is bearing any financial risk. So if they're incurring costs themselves, what does the wider context look like for them? Are they providing services to multiple end users? Do they engage through their personal service company and really operate as a business, maybe employing other staff? Each of those factors could be an indicator of a genuine contractor arrangement. And finally, we also need to consider the intention of the parties. So for tax purposes, generally, a contractor will prefer to be treated as a self-employed individual for reasons we've discussed. And usually clauses have express terms to say there is no intention to create any kind of employer-employment relationship, and the contractor understands that he or she is a genuine self-employed individual or third-party contractor. The court won't place a huge amount of emphasis on the intention, but it's still a relevant factor.
And so that, I guess, when we're trying to get as detailed a picture as possible of how the relationship works.
Yes, it is. The starting point is generally to look at what's in the engagement or the documentation between the parties. But really, in the more difficult cases, it could require sitting down and speaking to the contractor themselves and maybe even people within the business who are in receipt of their services, because it's not always clear on the face of it how ingrained a contractor is within the business and actually what they're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Presumably that is going to be quite a labor-intensive exercise for many businesses, particularly the ones which engage large contractor groups. Has the revenue made that assessment methodology any easier?
The first point to note on assessments really is that HMRC's guidance states that making a blanket assessment, so just saying, okay, this is too difficult, all of my contractors should be treated as employees, or none of them should be treated as employees for tax purposes, does not constitute reasonable care. So more work than that needs to go into this. HMRC do seem to accept that making these employment status determinations is challenging. They have released a tool called the Check Employment Status for Tax tool, the CESS tool. And the CESS tool is an online questionnaire that employers and contractors can complete. And it asks questions around whether there is a genuine right of substitution, whether one has actually been provided, ask questions around control and the wider employment status factors around provision of own equipment and whether the contractor is taking on their own costs. And it also talks about the intention of the parties and how that contractor would hold themselves out to clients of the end user. So would they say, I'm a third-party contractor, or would they say, I am really a representative and effectively an employee of that end user? And you might think about how they're portrayed, how the contractor is portrayed on a website, for example. It would be unhelpful if the website didn't distinguish between employees and that contractor. So the CESS tool allows contractors and end users to click through, provide their answers, and it will give one of three outcomes: either caught by the off-payroll worker rules, not caught by the off-payroll worker rules, or status cannot be determined. We've had a play with the CESS tool as it's developed over the last couple of years. And unsurprisingly, there are some questions, if they're answered in a certain way, will kick you one way or the other. So if you have an unfettered right of substitution, however the rest of the CESS tool is completed, the tool will say that an individual is not caught by the off-payroll worker rules. And equally, if you tick the right answers for control and you say, okay, the end user can't decide how, when, where services are provided, then it will always give you the outcome that the individual is not caught by these rules.
That doesn't sound massively sophisticated.
It doesn't. There are hundreds of pages of guidance that accompany the CESS tool. And HMRC's stated view is that they will stand by the output of a CESS tool if it is completed correctly. And given the amount of guidance and the grey areas and subjective nature of the way some of these questions are worded, that's quite a significant caveat. HMRC might look at an arrangement and think, oh, well, you ticked yes for that question, where we would have said, well, actually, in practice, it's no. And maybe in a lot of cases, it's sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's very, very difficult to draw the line. So despite the good intentions behind the CESS tool and the fact that in theory, it can put you on one side of the line or the other, managing a company's risk and helping them to understand what their potential exposure is in terms of the off-payroll worker rules, it really does leave a significant grey area outstanding.
Okay, I think that that probably brings us to a useful place to pause. So if you have any questions about the tax side of employment status, then Phil's email and phone number are in the episode description. If you have any questions about the employment rights, employment protection side of employment status, then my details are in the episode description. If you have any questions about other employment or tax matters, then feel free to get in touch with us. It only remains to thank Phil for his insight today and to thank you all for listening. We'll catch you again in June.
Thank you very much.